discover the true greatness of your own humanity.
Legends, the original podcasters. I mean, our person is about 2 months old. You guys have been in the podcast game for a lot longer. Like, tell me, how did this happen? How did Catching Foxes become what it is today?
So I made a terrible decision, and I moved to Denver, Colorado, without a job. And
was it for a girl?
No.
Was it because of the breakup?
No. Oddly enough, it was the one thing in my life that was not defined by that or our Lord. I was listening to a podcast, and it was a podcast called the I'm a Bad Christian podcast, and they were having these profound conversations that were what we talked about at a bar when we would go out. And I was like, we both love podcasts. I was like, I wish there was a podcast that talked about the stuff that I liked with my voice. And you know, I don't mean that in like a bad way, or do I? I just mean like a person who really cares about the faith, that isn't afraid to have really challenging, hard conversations, that is kind of unvoyeuristic and not scared of like putting all of their own garbage and stuff out there. And that I really just wanted to have a thing that kind of had like an open-ended, I was tired of like clean-cut talks. I'm like, that's not real life. And what I love about the podcast medium is that that's an opportunity to have long-form, open, tough conversations. So I called him and I said, I have an idea for a podcast.
And then I ignored it for about a year or two. And then we finally decided to do it. We pulled the trigger and we recorded 6 episodes that will never see the light of day. They are so terrible. And they were all 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
And they go nowhere. And we enjoyed them, but we burned them.
We thought it'd be funny to talk about GeoCities and Taylor Swift in every episode.
In every
because
episode.
2014 was a wonderful time.
Yeah.
But that's really the beauty of what you guys do, is that, you know, it's just an honest, genuine conversation between, I mean, you guys are friends for what, like, 20 years. That's like a college.
This August, yeah.
I mean, that's absolutely crazy. This is an overflow of the relationship that you guys have.
Best friends.
Not best.
Best friends.
Pretty good friends.
I've got like a cohort of friends now that I'll meet him. Nice. But if
good luck.
You guys might not be aware of this, but I now attend a school called the University of Notre Dame. Perhaps you've heard of it. And I have found a group of friends that I'm now very attached to. And it's been nice. And some people just get replaced. It's fine.
And the beauty is that you guys are actually so passionate about the medium, and what you guys do is so vulnerable. I was just telling him that, like, I knew that he just bought a Chrysler Pacifica. It's like,
that's very vulnerable. It's like, all my wounds.
Well, like, people know all. How do you guys deal with that? Like, people know all about your lives. Yeah. You travel the country. Like, is that weird?
It's very weird. Someone once posted a picture of a kid sitting next to a ice cream stand. Right, we buy ice cream, like popsicles and stuff. And it's a bunch of people. It's a picture of a bunch of people laughing, smiling, and eating popsicles. And there's a kid sitting next to the sign, laughing and eating the popsicle. And the caption said, "How I feel listening to my favorite podcasters." Because it's like, those people on the sign don't know who that person is. But I've had a person, this woman at my work, she walked up and she punched me in my arm and she goes, "What up, Gomer?" And she punched me out and then she froze and just went, "Oh my gosh, I just realized you don't know who I am, but I know every detail about your life." And I was like, "Yeah, no, that's fine. It's fine. Everything's fine. Just don't take pictures. Are you recording me right now?" So it has gotten weird sometimes, but most of the time, what you find is the type of conversations like that we had, which is simply this, people saying, "Hey, you were thinking the thing that I was thinking," or, "I fell into that same, you know, dark place that you shared, you know, X, Y, or Z." And so what ends up happening is it becomes this amazing connecting point with people that I don't know. It shrinks the world a little bit so that you realize you're not alone. To use that cliche, but it's very true. And all of a sudden, like, I just got back from the Steubenville Youth Conference, right? So about 2,000 kids in Springfield, Missouri, and we're hanging out, and these youth ministers walk up, and they're like, I'm a big fan of the show. I know you don't know me. I know you, but thank you so much for your witness. Your talks were great. And I told all my kids I have to download your podcast. And I'm like, oh no, not the kids, but you can say that I can. Yeah. So it's been a pretty awesome experience, though, because from that, the type of ministry that has accidentally happened has been like one woman. We have this a sex addict on our show. It's one of our episodes called An Interview with Joey Jojo Shabadoo, because he had to be anonymous, that's a Simpsons quote. And we started getting emails from people who were like, you have no idea how healing it was to hear someone talk about it. Even though it was open-ended, it wasn't resolved. This guy was still, to this day, still going through it. But the people that said like, oh my goodness, someone acknowledged this.
Yeah.
And as a Catholic, it brought a level of freedom in people's lives.
There is real healing when you dwell in reality, and there are times when it is appropriate to kind of pull that back. Because you want to like, I'm gonna be at the store and be like, I like the porn.
That's not a healthy way to go to a grocery store.
Yeah, not very. But there is a time and a place for just about everything. And there are times when it can be just one, like just like a couple people, and there are times when it can be a only couple people and 10,000 anonymous people. So, and it also helps that our wives don't listen. So, yeah, really that joke, Bob.
Yeah, no, it really is.
Really, yeah.
But it's super cool because it's so much more like real life. I mean, in the sense that like, in a talk, like you're delivering a particular message and it's super focused. But here it's like, there's the possibility that through conversation, things come up, minds are changed, like there's so much just open-endedness and so much more like how real life actually is.
And there's a time and place for a talk. Like, he's honestly probably one of the best in the country right now doing that.
You as a kid.
On Catholic audience. And so, I really do believe that. There are times that I'm like, sorry that I'm holding it back. But this is what we do. We have a good point and then we think of something funny, and it's like, oh, that's way more important. And then I have no idea.
What was you just talking about?
Yeah, what were you saying? Like important to have a good conversation.
Just open a conversation.
They sure are. Oh, here it is. It's like life's so complex, right? And there's a time and there is a place to have a talk. There are times when God plays a long game a lot. Not always. There are times where it's like, because we're an idiot, and then it does like happen. And I think that's what our show is about, the long game. Our opinion has changed so many times on like a lot of different things. Not like things just in terms of the faith or whatever, but how we live it out, how we view the world, the intention where we are trying to exist in. And I think when we talk about things like the power of personhood, it's that's where I think this stuff is like very important, because people are so dynamic. And I don't think people, I think we tend to like judge like, oh, you're this, so I'm gonna put you in this box because you like play sports, so you don't read, or like you read, so you don't play, and like those things are like so, it's a dumb box.
Yeah,
and
that's so not
and I think for us, we're trying to really mine stuff until, we will just keep going over and over.
Beat that door.
I will literally burn every bridge I can to get that Patreon money. So,
and I will say this, going off of that, what Luke just said, patreon.com/Thea, that's patreon.com/Thea. Talking about earlier, you were mentioning, Brian, about the experience of like anonymity from our audience, like they know everything about us. We have an amazing community in Patreon. We have 401 members, not like I'm tracking, but within that group, I have held a bunch of Zoom sessions. I have a Zoom account through my parish that I use liberally for catching foxes. And when we host these meetings, it keeps seeing the same faces that come up. And then in the middle of these things, you hear their stories and how they came to get attached to our stupid show. And so, the people who come from, these are people who are earnestly seeking the face of God. but cannot settle for a prescripted spirituality. And I know that, like, me and Luke met each other at Franciscan University of Sioux-Ville, our fall semester, freshman year. I love it for a sec. But there's so much at Franciscan, I think, that the prescripted nature of student spirituality, like, the teachers don't do this, the priests don't do this, but as students, you kind of push people into this, like, well, a good Catholic doesn't do that, a good Catholic, like, from an eye roll to a whatever. Like, that's the attitude that creates this a false cookie-cutter Christian that I think, honestly, many young adults begin to rebel against. Like, well, that's not who I am, but that doesn't mean that's who Christ is calling you to be, and now you're in open rebellion against our Savior. So much like life is an open-ended discussion, it's an open-ended narrative that keeps going, right? And hopefully it has an end that terminates in union with God forever. But that trajectory of trying to figure out who I am is the reason why Socrates said, know yourself is a lifelong process, right? So for us, the podcast is meant to be a real conversation between me and Luke that other people get to listen to. And I don't think there's ever, you can't help but once you have a microphone in your face to kind of talk to a microphone. But I don't think there's ever been anything said on that show that I wouldn't have said in real life. In the kind of honest back and forth. Sometimes it adds a little reality distortion, you know, you realize you're playing it up for an audience. But because me and Luke have that pre-existing relationship for 15 years before we started it, it enables us to kind of, as much as possible, bypass that. So,
And I think, like, also, too, going back to the idea of the power of a little person, like, if you think that, like, this stuff matters, and you haven't experienced the tension that we have right now just that is there between faith and reason, or between, like, God and the world, or, like, the, like, I'm a world and God, maybe you need to rethink things, because that's real. That is the way that, like, that's the challenge that we all have every day. And if we don't have conversations about what that is actually like, I would add up, we don't have appropriate ongoing conversations with the right people at the right time. You're going to turn inwards, and it's not going to end well, or it's not going well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's so easy to put people into a box, but that's why part of this idea of personhood is that, like, each and every single person out there is extremely unique and unrepeatable. Even just to hear that word, like, unrepeatable, and think about it to myself, like, the way that, like, people get at me all the time, I really like Myers-Briggs, like, these personality tests, but at the same time, like, you know, they can be so limiting, because you're saying, yeah, this person is this thing, but the fact that each and every single person, you know, and so part of the reason why we did this whole personhood series is, like, when we see famous people, or when we see celebrities, we can admire just their uniqueness and how cool they are and all these kind of things, but, you know, a lot of times we'll bunch, like, the poor or the suffering or the struggling or drug addict, like, you know, all these people kind of get bunched into a category, and then as regular Westerners, we think, oh yeah, let's think of a system to fix their lives, and we think that the system's going to fix their lives, but they're unique and unrepeatable. Like, if we don't recognize that first, then nothing is actually going to work. And so, yeah, so that's part of why we're here, and we're excited to have you guys here with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy to be here, huh? Are you guys happy we're here? The guy in the lightning shirt is so mad that we're here.
He's like, so I would rather Father Mike Schmidt.
I'd rather have the crunch here.
Clearly not aged well.
Unlike Father Mike Schmitz, who has aged a little too well. It's called Botox, people. I'm just kidding. Or am I?
Yeah, we'll throw anyone up under the bus and we get more down with it. So.
Yeah.
Just look at that name. We'll start. I'm no shame. I'm just kidding.
You know who doesn't believe in the power of personhood? Bishop Barron.
That'll sell about it. It'll be good. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you go from there?
Or where do you go from there?
I don't know how you guys do it. You guys, like, Do you guys talk every night?
A desperate good for attention.
We text each other.
That's all it is.
It's just like their chemistry.
Please love me! That's all it really is. It's just, you know.
Yeah, no, people have asked that all the time. Like, where do you get your banter from? And it's like, a desperate need to be loved.
Yeah.
That is your most fulfilling
with silence.
But seriously,
Tristan Summers didn't like me back in third grade. Oh my God, I need to
heal me, Gomer.
Yeah.
Are your wives jealous of each other now?
So we tell, me and Luke, whenever we talk about our wives, we always have this line that we say to each other, which was, I love you first.
Which is true.
I love you first.
Yeah.
When me and Luke lived together, every night we would go, when we would go to bed at the same time, we would go.
Secrets out.
Secrets out.
Secrets out. Secrets out. Secrets out. Secrets out. Secrets out. Which we've never done on the podcast.
Yeah. American Idol. Secrets out. We still don't, right? That's a dumb catchphrase.
And then we could also just do this other thing, which is wonderful.
No, let's not tell
them. So.
Go on.
No, so what we would do is, there was this rock band called Chevelle, and they had a sad acoustic song about getting dumped. And we would just turn it up in a room in the dark and sit there and listen to it and be like, oh yeah, we have so many feelings.
Yeah, so when you're emotionally shallow and you're an extrovert and you have wounds of desperate neediness, what I summarize it as, you're a narcissist but with low self-esteem. The only outlet is a microphone and as broad an audience as possible.
We've found a way to get paid for what ashamed our lives. So. Why are we still talking about this? I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. These are all the jokes that like yeah, I promise we are almost done. About like that stuff. We have a lot of other stuff to say, but about us.
So how about the power of personhood?
Yeah.
So yeah, what was like, obviously podcasters didn't navigate through the pandemic, but what was the pandemic like for you guys otherwise?
Horrible.
Awesome. No, I mean, March, when it hit, I was scared, like I'm sure everyone else. I honestly felt like I was living in a, like, movie, like this 12 Monkeys or something, like some horrible virus is going to... Now, what you may not know is me and my wife were in New York City on a romantic vacation, just the two of us, before New York City... editor content. Before New York City shut down. And I was where hotel was in Times Square. We took a subway and then a light rail car all the way to Long Island.
They sent me multiple times. It was a great vacation.
Yeah, I licked a lot of doorknobs, which I probably shouldn't have done, but that was a joke. And came back and I had this mysterious illness and I was fatigued for days. But that was in January. In March, when everything shut down, and we knew it, we knew what was going on, you know, somewhat, and I couldn't go to work. I would wake up in the morning, and I would go downstairs, and I would open my garage, and I took a lawn chair out there, and I would make a cup of coffee for me and my wife, and we would sit there, and we would pray the liturgy of the hours, and our kids would play in the front. And it was weird, because that first week, no one was outside except my kids. And then slowly, people started buying bikes off of, like, Facebook Marketplace, and you started seeing families outside doing things. And I just realized at this moment, like, I made my life too busy. Because otherwise, I would have gone on 6 different trips in the month of March doing parish missions. Because it's Lent. That's when a Catholic speaker makes that money, baby. So instead, I lost, you know, almost half of my income. And I could not have asked for a better wake-up call that I'm not with my kids enough. Now that I've gone through the pandemic, I realized I don't want to be with them that much, so I'm starting to travel again. But no, it was now
back and better than ever.
No, but the honest truth is, it was awesome for about 3 months, and then it became the hardest parish ministry, personal stuff. I mean, I'm an extrovert. We had tons of potlucks at my house. We never stopped barbecuing. But my experience in parish life went from you, Michael Gormley, or this evangelist, you love the gospel in season and out of season, to you're a scum-sucking jerk, open up the parish now. Like, we got it from both sides all the time of you're not doing enough to safeguard our people from the pandemic, you're kowtowing to the government for the sake of this made-up pandemic, and we just got hammered every single day as a parish employee. And I'm on the leadership team, so I got all the emails. Everything went to the pastor. went to us, you know, and you just see this. And it became so overwhelming. And it's like, I'm just trying to keep our church together. Like, I don't even know how to deal. Like, I don't know, how many pandemics have you been through, good sir? Right. So, you know,
Okay, well, why?
You are old. You were there in San Francisco in 1918. No, but it was so upside down. And Catholic Stuff You Should Know, a great podcast. If you don't know, it's a number one Catholic podcast. After Father Mike Schmitz. But these priests were all getting together, and he goes, when did we become the liberals? And that was the way of saying, like, everyone's saying that we are compromising the gospel. We're just doing, we're following our
mission. That was more about, yeah, it was about that.
It was the whole deal. But that's what we get as a parish employee. And so that's when the demoralization and depression and anxiety, you know, the job fears and all that crept in.
I had really high hopes. I was going to learn a Latin. I spoke with one of our listeners who's actually a priest out in Alex in Wales. He told me to buy some books. We were going to talk on the phone every week. I thought it was going to be a couple of weeks. I worked for a group called the Glen Mary Home Missioners, who, if you guys don't know who they are, they're the best kept secret of the American church. They're a group of all the priest brothers that go to a part of the country where the population is less than 1% Catholic, and you have unemployment rates twice as high as the national average. They're a Catholic presence where there quite literally is none. And I was able to go across the country to raise money for them, and it all stopped. And it was really hard for me because at that time, Erin, my wife, was about 6 months pregnant. And so she was about to hit the part where it's like, this is I'm kind of hard. And I'm like, I got a podcast. And all of a sudden, it was just hard for her to, she was pregnant. That's a lot of work. And we didn't have any, we had just moved to this other part of town, and life just stopped. And it did for everyone. And I think that I was really isolated in a way that I had only experienced probably once in my life before, and that was for about 2 months. And this was a long time of that. And it just got worse and worse, not like worse, but it just kept going and going. So I pretty much from the get-go was like, oh, this is gonna be horrible until this ends.
You know, and for those of you who don't understand, I'm an extrovert. I enjoy being around people. I get great joy being with people. Luke makes me seem like an introvert because Luke is so extroverted.
It's true.
He's like a shark in the water. Like, it still swims while it sleeps or else it'll die. Like, Luke still has to be with people 24/7. So not only did the pandemic hit and shut down all the stuff that Luke would frequent with his U.S. men's national team love and all that stuff, but because he had a baby on the way, he had to double down the quarantine.
Yeah,
and I didn't have to do that at all. And I had we had a handful of friends that I work with, and our wives are friends. So we would literally once a week take turns going to each other's houses because we're already in each other's lives all the time anyway. And so I never felt alone or isolated. I never felt isolated. I was back in the office full time since April 1st of 2020. So I was, so a lot of stuff that Luke went to as the most extroverted of extroverts, he had to get isolated, and I didn't. And so a lot of that side of things, within the pandemic didn't hurt. But it made us really focus on the podcast because there was nothing to be on.
Yeah, yeah. And it's weird when, the things you take for granted. Okay, so I was just at an airport for the first time since early March of 2020, and it was just so jarring. It was really odd, but not in a good way. I was also exhausted, so there's that. But because I can't be like, Luke, just go to bed at a decent time for love, all that's good. And it's weird how much of your day-to-day life, when that is gone, it's like, well, then what and who am I and what is this and why do I exist? So that was a really tough thing to try to navigate. And then when you have all the stuff that's going on, you have the Black Lives Matter stuff, you guys, the church and her utter insanity. You got January 6th, you've got all this stuff, and it's like I was actually in therapy because, I'm over 30, so I think kind of have to be. I was like, yeah, I've got this going on, I've got this, and there are all sorts of riots. It's like the height of the riots. It's like the height of I was just going back to work, but it was at like 2 to 3 times per week, and there's a, and where I worked, it's the same, like on our on Glen Rex campus, you have a lot of elderly, priests and brothers, and so you can't be around them. So like you were quarantined at work, and I was basically going to be by myself for 8 hours, three times a week, which in like hindsight was just a terrible thing. I should have just said, I'm just gonna hang out now. And that was just really, when that stuff happens, when you're put to your limits, there is this aspect of like, you know, some people have it, like, it'll be good and the kids will be happy, but we were home all the time. And there's a while, I think we all had a point where it's like, actually I'm severely broken. And now I have to find a way to God to help me put this, like, we all won't be the same. I think it's important to just really acknowledge that, like, this heavy stuff is hard, and it's, you will not be the same coming out of this.
And it's crazy because, like, we're, as a, just an entire world, we're so connected to each other.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing videos, we're seeing tweets, like, there's such a sense of,
mm-hmm.
hey, this world is so connected and dependent on each other, we're this one global family, but actually the pandemic just exposes all of the inequalities. Like, you see some people don't even have a hiccup. They can continue going to work, just working from home. Other people totally lose their jobs. Some kids can have online school and not have an issue. Other kids,
yeah.
like, literally are going a whole year without, like,
yeah.
missing it. And so it's like, this world is so interdependent to each other. Like, is that good? Is that bad? Like, obviously, there's things like catching foxes that, because of the global nature, it's like it gets all over the world, but at the same time, like there's this other really hard side to it where like, inequality is just so vast.
I was going to say quickly out the gate, you know, he said, like, the experience of dependence is and interdependence is something that we need to realize is fundamental to every human.
Yep.
We are, as Alistair McIntyre, professor at Notre Dame, says, we are dependent rational animals. Like, that is what we are. We are dependent. I have never farmed. My wife kills every plant in our house. She killed a cactus. How do you kill a cactus? She found
it. Shannon Gormley knows how.
Shannon Gormley knows how.
With some Bud Light and some NASCAR and a bad attitude.
So, my wife loves NASCAR. It's weird. I can't do that. I don't know how to farm. I don't know how to butcher a cow. I'm willing to learn. But I can't. I'm dependent on a farmer. Now, this is what we can do. This goes to the personal thing. Is that because of my sinfulness and brokenness, I could use the farmer and disregard his ends, his wants, his goals, his dreams. I can, and this is where it most manifests, right? Is I use the person at the grocery store. I can, you know, and not even regard them as a human person. I can treat them as a cog in a machine. You know, you're just here to scan my things, tell me the total, take my coupons while I write my check and delay the line 20 minutes. Right, that's what we're here for, right? But in the experience of instrumentalizing people, what happens is we hide our dependence on one another by proclaiming and fooling ourselves that we are independent. And really, the goal of the human person is not to be independent, but to be interdependent. Which means I realize I have a whole host of dependencies, and you can also depend on me as I depend on you. This is the JP2 line that's so amazing. No man is so rich he has nothing to receive, nor so poor that he has nothing to give. But the problem is when we reduce human persons and their needs to a number, to something quantifiable, rather than giving of yourself to another, what ends up happening is we reduce the huge global impact and all the inequalities to just things like money and commodities, and if only we shuffle this stuff around. When one of the episodes of the podcast I wasn't able to be on because I was flying, Luke did this interview with a guy named Shane Claiborne. He said, how do I treat the panhandler on the side of the road? And he said, more than your money, more than giving them a food ticket, right? Like a lot of people will buy coupons to like McDonald's so they're not contributing to their drug or alcohol addiction, but you know, here, go get food, go stay alive, you know? He said, go talk to them, because the loneliest people on the face of the earth are homeless people. And so when a couple weeks after that, we were interviewing this guy that we love, this Aaron Weiss, who's the head of the band Me Without You, And I went there 30 minutes early with drinks, like waters and all this stuff, because I knew I was going to meet homeless people here in downtown Houston. And I went early just so I could have conversations with them. And to me, that meant more than being able to give them McDonald's, you know, here's your meal, and all this stuff. So the exposure of inequalities, I think, is very true. But we should also notice that they are exposures of our very human interdependence. And I want to point out that they had to tell Luke how to have microphone control. Every time we do a live show, we always are like, closer your mouth, Luke, closer your mouth.
I'm always scared that I'm going to be too much.
You are a bit too much.
So quickly, huh? Yeah, so one thing about COVID that was so interesting, I think I really don't think about this a lot, was it was like everything got a whole bunch of roids. Like, if everything was awesome, it got like very, very awesome. If it was bad, it was like, it's really, really bad. And I think this is a lot better. I'm sorry about that. I think that the really interesting part is that we microdose. Like, we're able to, like, so we say that we want to be, like, a part of people, we say that, like, we are attached, but, like, we live in Brave New World, not 1984, or both, I don't know, things really could be horrible, where I get my, like, hits of, I get my hits of community from here, or I have, like, a dose of sexuality, of, like, I'm sex if I go to this thing over here, or I can just get my own fix, and then I'm good. And so it's like, we aren't really ever anything, because we're just getting the dopamines, or just getting the, like, I'm a rush, or this is the danger of a show like Friends, or say, How I Met Your Mother, which I really like, How I Met Your Mother at the time, and, like, hindsight's kind of a bit much, but it's like a microdose of like, what it's like to have Friends. It is a McDonald's version of, let me just feel like I'm at a bar, hanging out, I'm good. And when the actual possibility of being able to do that, when you are really robbed of that, you see how important that is. And I think one of the reasons why we have all this tense stuff happen is because you're forced, that's all you can see is just like, oh my gosh, this really isn't good. There is an income inequality. We have these crazy things happening. I don't like, hate you, we have all this stuff. And it gets to a point where it's like, I don't know what to do but be like overwhelmed. So I can either be overwhelmed, or I think these were my options. I can really either be overwhelmed, or I can just find a way to like numb it just enough so it's always there, but it's at, you know, like arm's length. So I care because hashtag blessed. You know, like really, and I feel good because I'm like blank city, you know, so I'm like, what do you call it? Dayton Strong was the thing when we really had the shooting. If I heard Dayton Strong come one more time, I was gonna flip out. I'm like, Dayton's not strong right now. A guy just came out and shot a whole lot of people, and it was horrible. And I was there like the night before it happened, and it was crazy to see where I took a picture the night before, people died like right there. I'm not strong right now about that. I'm pretty like it's like a false reality. Like, how can we become human beings if we want to run from suffering? Or if like in the face of that, all we like have is like, you'll persevere, or like you'll be fine.
We have cliches.
Yeah.
And the bizarre thing is, I don't think we realize this in America. But the goal was, we're in the pursuit of happiness, and we exchange that word happiness with all of its different meanings and stuff, and the word comfort with its one meaning, which is a sense of softness, a lack of affliction, a lack of confrontation. I just want to be comfortable. And the amazing thing is, and this might be weird, but I have friends who are addicted to like Disney World and stuff. You're not addicted. I'm not talking about you.
Almost.
You enjoy it. You dip in, you dip out.
Yeah.
But, like, and I was listening to this guy talking, Matthew Crawford, I'm a big fan of his book, The World Beyond Your Head, and he talked about how where there is this existential void, corporations come in to sell you a custom-tailored but flattened experience. And where we lose tradition, we lose family, and we lose religion, corporations have rushed into that moment. And it kind of made me happy that custom-tailored experiences for corporations shut down. Don't get me wrong. It was awful with the job loss and stuff. But I mean, like, the Disney worlds of the world couldn't operate. And what I heard was one of two things happened. One, people got along and did family things more. Or two, family life became unbearable. So that's when you hear the statistics of family violence, domestic violence going up, pornography consumption going up, alcoholism going up. like, I remember a buddy of mine works for a bar, and he was like, you know, the you can't even keep beer on the shelves. And then you realize, like, oh, that's because of widespread depression, and now I have to confront the bad marriage that I actually have, and instead of confront it, I'm gonna go watch Netflix and get hammered. Because the online corporations can still stream to you those micro doses of anesthetic apathy. And it becomes very dangerous when we have that always on hand. And I've always had this, but like, it's so hard for me to turn off YouTube. I love YouTube. Anyone love YouTube out here? Anyone got favorite channels they follow? Right, like all that stuff, and I'm just like, yes, algorithm, feed me, I'm hungry. And all of a sudden, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, you're like, what happened to my life? It's worthless.
I'm just numb, but I have so many good intentions now.
Yeah, I may or may not finish a deck. I may or may not detail my car. I may or may not, there's all the DIY stuff. Did anyone watch DIY stuff? Yes, yes, there we go.
You should all be ashamed.
I painted one room and I did that poorly. Never again, never again.
It's really easy. Okay, there's a time and a place for anger, as I've learned with my own podcast. And as I've also learned, there's a time and a place when it's like, maybe back up a little bit. And the danger of we think that it's good to try to fight evil, right? Or it's good to try to fight injustice or try to push back. It's also very, very easy to just push back. And if you read, what is it solidarity? It's like being, you really want to will the, I want to will your good to the point where I'm actually going to do something.
Yeah.
Well, here is the thing. Doing something is really hard. I would like to lose about 50 pounds. COVID hit me kind of hard. And I also had a stroke, and I can't lose weight. I know, it was weird. Apparently, you go to a chiropractor and be like this, and it doesn't go well. It like tears your neck, and then it doesn't work. And so, blah, blah, blah. And I'm fine. I just can't ride rides anymore. It's fine. There are my problems, everyone. If you're so, it's very easy to want to stay in that spotlight, Daniel. Like, I will never forget this image of when they tore, so the guy who helped make the city of Bristol of England, as big as it was, he made his money through the slave trade. And he basically funded the whole town. And it's been the shame of the city ever since then. And when they started to tear down all of that stuff, there was this one, one image of this girl who tore down the statue and she danced on its head. And I was like, this is so weird. In one sense, I get it. This is a person who did horrible things, and you have to live with the fact that you have benefited from the horrible things that the evil that this man has done has actually benefited your life somehow. But there was something about it that felt like it was really more about just being seen and doing that than actual change. It's easy to tear up a statue. It's really hard to be how can I, if I really want to be in solidarity, I'm with you. If I want to will your good, I need to do something beyond just I'm angry. I need to give you money. I need to perhaps change my life and priority. I need to change how I live. I need to say, it's not just about giving you money. I need to actually be friends with the poor. Do I have friends? I was very challenged by the whole Black Lives Matter. A movement where I was like, if we want to talk about this, we've got two people that we can ask really, that we could have on the show and have an honest conversation who we know. Two. That's really pathetic. Out of all the Black Catholics that there are, we have two people. That is pathetic. And it bothered me. It bothered me to a point where this is why we never had anyone on. Because if I have you on, you're just a token on Black guy. You're having it on our show. And I honestly felt terrible about the fact that I still do. And I don't know how to fix that quite yet. Besides just going, I need to go and make more Black and Catholic friends to hear about their experience, not based really everything that I think about them based upon what someone on YouTube is saying. What are you actually saying? What is your experience? What can I actually do to try to make this better? Because there's something broken here. And that's what solidarity is. And that's what real personhood actually demands a thing
from me. And when you have a life, and this is why I think COVID was like so hard, was because think about like what was demanded out of all of us. Not much. I didn't really have to do much. I could read, I read all like 8 books of Harry Potter in like 9 days. It was weird. Like, I didn't have to do, I just watched a lot of movies and I hung out and I'm like, this is a miserable way to live because nothing was really demanded at it. I had nothing, I like honestly, my like main job was, this is my poor wife, this is not a bit of fun. Like, she was throwing up every day for 9 months. And my main job was to take the bag, tie it up, like put it out in the trash, and then repeat. And that was it. That's all I really, I mean, there was other stuff I didn't do, but like that
and was. And you couldn't even do that.
Yeah, right?
Couldn't.
It was like, you have one job, and I'm like, I have feelings I'm gonna talk about it on the show. And then, I'm going on like a rant here, so I'm gonna stop. But that, like, that is the tension where, like, I think aspect personhood is, because it's not meant to be easy. Like, we want the resurrection, but we don't want to have the cross. Or we want to have the cross, but we don't want to have the resurrection. And, or we don't want to have to deal with all the little things that kind of go on in that. And that's life. Like, if there's one thing I want to just, like, scream at everyone, it's like, live in the tension. Because that's where God is. God is in our humanity. In the day-to-day experience, that's where God is. Like, this stuff is great, and I'm so like happy to be here. But what's more important, guys, is like when you go home, when you are like, you know, in your room, hanging out, that's where God is. When you're at work, that's where God is. This is great. This isn't reality. This is a nice little happy break, and I'm thrilled to be here. But God is in reality, and that is very, very difficult at times.
Yeah, and solidarity is kind of this buzzword. You know, a lot of people think that it's charity, it's philanthropy, and it's kind of been warped into those things. Mm-hmm. Like, philanthropy is something that rich people do. Charity is something, you know, when I have excess, I'm giving. But, you know, solidarity is something that's altogether different, and it's way more tied to justice. And obviously, like, I thought one of the really cool things about what happened during the pandemic is, like, finally there was a wake-up call about Black Lives Matter. There was a wake-up call that there are inequalities in our world, you know, that people felt such a sense of justice. But, you know, one of the frustrating things for me is, you know, the easiest and most common response was to put something on the gram or tweet about it or talk about it. You know, for me, I went to Haiti when I was 26, 27 years old. I saw things that I never thought existed in the world. You know, I was stupid enough to think that every kid in the world goes to school. I mean, but the reality was, when I saw kids that were, you know, 8 years old sitting on the sidewalk at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday, it's like, oh my gosh, like, I literally took all 12 years, the years that I went to college, for granted. And then there are kids here that are just, they don't know how to read, they don't know how to write, they're just looking for that opportunity. And then I'm confronted with this serious question. It's like, all right, am I gonna go back to my job? Am I gonna go back to my cubicle in New York? And just, you know, I was in finance at the time, I was like, am I just gonna help?
Were you in finance or finance? It's about a $40,000 difference.
Yeah, it was the lower one.
Okay, sure. It was finance.
But I
was... No high to us, we're in a ministry, so yeah. Tell me what it's like to feel unsafe and secure.
But yeah, so it's like, do you go back to just what life is normally like, or do you try, you know? And then Pope Francis talks about this. You were saying, like, about the confusion with comfiness, comfort, and like, yeah. But he's like, go make a mark in this world. Go do something. Go change something. Like, how sad is it to go through this entire life, like, just sitting on a sofa, just thinking that life is just this comfortable experience? Like, go do something, make a difference. It doesn't have to be like something huge, but like, all of us can make a difference in someone's life one way or the other. And that's real justice, right? Like, that's not what we're giving to them out of our excess, but it's what's due to them.
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing. In the history of the world, it wasn't until the 1700s that the term justice cease to be a virtue that one possesses, right? So from the ancient Greek philosophers, Judaism is a little bit different because it gave us a concept of a divine lawgiver and justice and righteousness due to that lawgiver. But within the kind of classical conception of justice, it is a virtue whereby I render unto others what is their due. So it's something within me that is a power that enables me to do something towards you. But in the modern term, that definition of justice was gotten rid of, and it was essentially a competition between individual rights and state authority. And so what you have in this new world is not justice is something required of me, but justice is something that I'm owed, that I have to like fight for or protest in order to keep, right? So to keep my rights, right? It's so funny because it becomes this external thing that becomes inward focused rather than an internal thing that goes outward. And when it ceases to be a virtue, it ceases to be my personal concern. So if you stop listening to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, if you stop listening to the New Testament, to Thomas Aquinas, to Augustine, if you take yourself out of that tradition, what you end up doing is you fall prey to the modern trap where protest becomes a symbolic way of demanding justice, but not doing a thing about it. That's why we have people that say the Mahatma Gandhi phrase, be the change, right? Which has totally become a cliche today, but that phrase, be the change, could better be stated as become just in order to see justice, right? Now, when you look at solidarity from a Catholic perspective, at its deepest core, solidarity is rooted in what Jesus did. Though he was rich, he became poor so that by his poverty, we might become rich. And that phrase in 2 Corinthians is so powerful for us because what he's essentially saying, right? You go into Philippians chapter 2, that though he was in the form of God, did not deem equality with God as something to be grasped, but rather he emptied himself to be like us. Think about the implications of the incarnation. That the divine word that spoke creation into existence took on flesh, became one of us, and in the same lofty prologue to John's gospel, came to his own people and his own people received him not. Right, like even in the midst of here's the word that was at the very beginning is still rejected. And in the middle of that, it's like, okay, so here's the infinite solidarity of God. Solidarity rooted as a fundamentally Christian ideal. He did this for us, but he did not have to. He who knew no sin became sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. That idea is exactly what is behind Mother Teresa's vision of serving the poor. It blew my mind when me and Luke were doing an event and we were with some CFR Franciscans up in Alaska. And it was an amazing event. But we were talking about his order and he said, Franciscans have become amazing at building institutions that serve poverty. But we Franciscans stopped serving the poor. And he said it was Father Benedict Rochelle, if you don't know Father Benedict Rochelle, founder of the CFRs with Father Andrew Bosley. He said he looked at the witness of Mother Teresa and he says, what's different about the way she serves the poor than the way we serve the poor? And he realized it was, oh, personal connection. It was the hands-on. He says, I'm running the world, you know, Brooklyn's largest soup kitchen, and I never see a poor person. We have volunteers that come in and we're feeding, but I'm abstracted seven levels of management. And so he realizes he's adopted this all-too-American approach, which is put distance between me and the problem, but use my programs to solve the problem. And what he realized was he was no longer in solidarity. So when they started the CFRs, they made sure, just like Mother Teresa's order, where you place yourself right now into the poorest of the poor, you know, the communities that are hurting the most, you go right to where the hurt is the deepest. That's where the healing can be the most radical. And for those of you sitting down here, feel like you have a call to ministry, one of the things I have learned in ministry is we keep fishing where there's already 1,000 other people fishing. And it's generally because it's safer there in that end of the pond, the lake, the river, whatever. But if we go to where other people aren't and start fishing, that's where you'll see the hand of God because it's like, oh, you've been abandoned even by Christians. Come, let me serve you, right? And so that thing set off the CFRs who have never had a vocation problem since they started because you can't help but see there's something radically different. And I would say in a real way, that something different is solidarity. The notion of I'm not so clean as to step away from those unwashed masses, but rather like Christ, I will enter into it. Right? This kind of is a weird analogy now in light of the pandemic, but without sanitized hands, right? This notion of I'm not trying to, again, these are all words and phrases I've used in different talks. They don't work anymore. I'm not going to quarantine myself.
All that comes out of this.
Yeah. I'm not going to quarantine myself from the world's hurt. Because Christ did it. When we look at the cross, we might have all these devotions, he took my sin. He entered into the place of rejection between humanity, the very fundamental alienation between humanity and divinity, between man and God, and he said, yes. He said, yeah, 2 Corinthians opens up. We did not preach yes and no to you, but yes in Christ Jesus. And that's what they need to recover.
Good philanthropy is solidarity. So I look at fundraising. I really view my work as I'm trying to help this person do a thing that they care a lot about. So if you are a philanthropist, the idea is that you're giving money to a thing that you really, really care about. I want to see this change. I care about the Catholic schools. I care about the poor. I care about the poor in Haiti, to the point where I'm going to give a gift in my will. They get 10% of my life's work or something like that. And if you happen to work at fundraising, I don't know if there's anyone here who does, but if you do, respect. We have great job security because no one wants to do it. My job is to help them be in solidarity to the point where perhaps they're face to face with the people whose lives are being changed to the point where I might ask for a gift that is beyond anything that they ever thought they could give, but they want to because they care that much, to the point where they're like, I want to do something concrete to help you because I care that much. So if you give up $10 to say some GoFundMe group because you have a friend who is sick, well, that is kind of almost solidarity, but how can you do that even more? Have you written them a card? Have you called them? Have you gone to say hi? That's what real philanthropy is. It's not just my money, but it's my time, it's my talents, and it's my treasure. And when you combine that with trying to will the good of the other, and I would really encourage you all. It's kind of heavy, but it's awesome because it's Benedict to read charity in truth. It is very, very, very good. And one of the key parts of this is that he says it's important to give it freely. That when we are talking about how do we help others. Especially when it comes to how to use money to help others. You have to give freely. Don't count the cost. We kind of have a saying where it's like we have a donor who would say, you have $1,000 and I want to see this, and this. That is really fine, but we're gonna really don't try to do that. But if it keeps going and it keeps going and it really keeps going, it's like, if that's not a gift, this really, and I don't want that. I want a gift. I want you to give to a thing because these people, they are owed that. It is a just thing to give to this group. And that's what I'm, and if you put too many one of the big challenges that we currently have in fundraising is there actually too many, we have too many what we call donor restricted gifts. To the point where we actually had a college that had a $9 million endowment. They almost had to close down because they couldn't really use any of it. They didn't have the people that fit all the scholarships and stuff. So people thought they were given a gift, but it actually almost killed. It almost killed the whole thing. And that really is a danger of if we think we're being involved, but it's really more about us. That's not a gift. That's use. You're using this group to feel good about yourself. That's what poverty porn is, I think. Yeah. Where it's like, I feel good, I got my hit, now I'm good. We just don't have a cool podcast about why it's bad. And so you really if you guys give, again, $10 to say some type of I'm gonna go fund you thing, or to a Catholic high school, or to a thing that you really don't care about, are you volunteering there? Like, are you actually, or is it just like, here's my own $10, I feel bad? That's what I call a transactional gift, where it's like, you kind of care, but that's not on solidarity. That's not, like, actual philanthropy. That's just like, you know, that's fine. But, like, really, are you giving almost to the point where it actually kind of hurts? That's what real charity is, the point where it's like, now I've got it, now I've got to go without. Now I can't have Netflix this like month, or, and now like you guys, I know, like, I know it's very hard to give as a young American. I get it. I lived through two crazy recessions, right? But we can always give more. We always can.
Yeah, and we see that a lot, even with mission trips, like the whole idea of volunteerism, like people go down on mission trips, and we love mission trips because it helps people actually see a reality that's so different than what they used to. But, you know, when I'm confronted with this tremendously different reality of people, whether they're poor or they're different culturally, whatever, right, like, how do I respond? You know, and it's so interesting that you pointed that thing about justice, because you're right, like justice today is something that I'm expecting the government to do, but justice is actually, you know, a virtue.
It's a virtue.
And a virtue is something that I have to practice day in and day out, you know, in little ways all the time. Otherwise, it's not cultivating in my life.
And that's how you find the balance between how do I, like, try to upsave the world and not go insane. Because, like, I have a lot of things I really care a lot about. But if I don't give my wife the proper amount of attention she's due, I'm not living that's an injustice. So if I spend all my time over hanging out with the poor, it's gonna sound kind of horrible. But it's at the expense of like Aaron and Emily, that is an injustice. And so that's where there are times like how, like, there's just like, I'm so much, how do I handle this? Well, what can you do? Can you do like 2 hours a week? Can you do 5 hours a month? Because there are, like, listen, like, I can't do, I wish I had that attitude more when I was single. I wish I volunteered more. I wish I had
100%.
I wish I had done more, because now I don't have the time. There's always more that I can do. But there is that dynamic of like, who do I owe? Like, who really can get my time?
Who here is single right now? Raise your hand if you're single.
And maybe we're
if you're ready to mingle,
let's see the armpit in the air. There we go. She's ready. Right there. In the white. I saw that.
In its court, right? St. Paul says, for the married man is anxious about things of the world and how to please his wife, which as a married man, I can tell you that's all I care about. Whereas the unmarried man is anxious about things of the Lord and how to please the Lord. There is a beautiful gift in singleness that might not last your whole life. It might be a season, it might be your life, you know, whatever. But the Lord can call you to do some radical giving that otherwise would not be accomplished. But like, I have a sister-in-law who goes to Africa as a nurse, because she did this, you know, as a nurse you get to travel, you get to do all these things. Well, she went to Africa as a volunteerism, and her whole life was changed because she saw, like you, she had an awakening. And then, so now she goes and spends 5 months out of the year there. And she goes and serves without cost, right? And it's incredible. So this is, you know, for me and my thing, when it comes to solidarity, you also have the other principle of subsidiary. Right, if y'all are familiar with that. Subsidiary essentially is higher authorities, higher levels, owe it to the lower levels that if a problem can be solved at the lower level, keep it at the lower level. Individual, family, municipality, community, neighborhood, church. The problem with America today, right? That's a bold statement. Let's see if it could go anywhere. But I
tell
me
more about your great American novel.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
The worst of times?
That's a Simpsons bit. Anywho, the idea, the problem with America right now is we do not have, or we are quickly running out of what we call intermediate institutions. Right? So you can't solve the world's problems. You can't solve the problems that launch a riot or Black Lives Matter, whatever it might be. You can't solve that because it's much bigger than you. It's at a higher level. So one of the things I heard that I found was so fascinating. You look at something like poverty, right? You divide it into three categories. You have relief, development, and reform. Relief is something that I can do. It's an immediate thing. I can teach a kid. I can walk with one kid. I can take a kid who, we have a buddy who, he was a teacher and his father died and he's a second grader. So my buddy started taking him to baseball games and to the movies, right? Like, I'm here to help out. I'm here to do what I can. That's immediate relief. The individual can do that. Then the next step up, it would be like development. Like, I'm going to build a program to help you, but you can't do that on your own. You can do some of it on your own, but you need a group to do that, right? You need others. You need a community to help sustain the common good. And then you have that next step, which is reform, which is like, all right, let's look at the structure of society, systems, things that are really disruptive, and that might need to be a much higher level thing. So when I look at Lumen Vitae, when you begin to see what it's doing, it's a mediating institution between the individual or the family and the state, right? And, you know, the federal government wastes more money than anything else. It wastes more money than it does good. But that doesn't mean it doesn't do good and it doesn't have certain things that are proper to it. Like, the national defense should be at a national level, right? But when it comes to Catholics helping people in Haiti, helping children learn how to read, you know, the Haitian government, for what it is, has not been able to educate these kids. So then the cool thing is, okay, what national, what international, what solidarity movement can we create where individual, where on a local level, you very, like, people know you. Like, and they know the Jesus Youth Program, they know Lumen Vitae, and you have a direct experience of the people actually solving the problem. So you're at that intermediate level where it's not the federal government expected to go and solve all the problems by throwing money at it. It's individuals going and doing a part of change. Like, you just changed. I mean, how many kids did you help get to school?
Yeah, 600 going on 12.
Okay, 600 kids. Like, you did not change the world. You changed 600 worlds, right? You changed the trajectory of an entire kid's life. So we read all that stuff like toxic missions and all that stuff. And at my church, we go to Honduras. Right, and we sponsor one place. We have multiple trips that go there because we're like, we want to invest in you. And the first thing we did was ask, what should we not bring? And you know what everyone asked us? They said, don't bring clothes. You know why? We put the local people out of business. All these kids are all walking around with Woodlands High School t-shirts, and you know, and now they don't have to go to the local store. So we realized, like, hey, what can we do? A two-classroom school. K through four in one room, or K through three in one room, four and fifth in the other room. So what did we do? We said, okay, well, we can build more on this school. So for the first time in the history of this community, a mountain community, far removed, now they have a middle school. They've never had a middle school. We fund a teacher, we fund multiple teacher salaries, all of that stuff. Guess what's happening? Kids are going to high school for the first time in the history of the four mountain villages that are all there. So we didn't change the world. Chances are you might never have heard of Trujillo, Honduras. But now on a mountain in Trujillo, there are dozens and dozens of kids who are going to have a better life than their parents, right? And you begin to see that movement. What are their kids going to be like? That's that intermediate stage of development that can actually change entire courses of people's lives. And when people see that, participate in it, it's not just, I'm going to pay my taxes and wait for the federal government to fix the problem. It's not like, I'm going to wait for the Rome to send priests to, you know, this no-priest land, America. No, Glenbury Home Missioners, a society, they're going to go, right? You guys, just you see the need, you identify, and you go. I think the biggest problem that we have is, well, what if it costs me too much? And the answer is, that's right where you need to be. Because it will. You'll kind of feel like sometimes, I'm sure, when you're doing your charity work, you think like, I'm serving, they love me, I love them, the tongues and perfect photos and all of that stuff. It's all the warm feelings you think when you're doing charity.
With the right filter.
and then you go and you do it and you realize like half of it is like trying to get the driver to not steal your vehicle. Like, we had a truck that we got in Trujillo, and they stole all the tires off the truck, and he was our driver. Like, what do you do? Right? So you have all these things, you're like, Lord, I'm trying to do your will. And he just says, yeah, it looks a lot like the cross, doesn't it? And you're like, could it not? Yeah. Could we just skip to Easter Sunday?
Could one ministry just look like the Transfiguration? And I think they do, and it's called focus. Here's the thing. One day this podcast is going to end.
Not obscene enough for like a girl in the white back there. But and it's probably gonna end like with a like oh like a whimper. You know, or man, who knows? They're gonna feel like a huge epic. What if they had a big fight? That's how we ended it. It'd be amazing.
The problem would be a real fight.
Yeah, yeah. Like
you're dreaming. I never fight.
But like one, like here's like one day it is going to end. Like this is all like it's going to end. I know it's more chances of my marriage than this. No, I'm just kidding. I love you first. Yeah. It was so cute when I first met him. He had like a Deftones hat, and he had this "I'm a Rock for Life" shirt, and he's like, "I'm gonna talk to anyone. I'm so hard. I'm a new metal. I'm gonna eat my Lucky Charms." You're like, what is like this guy's deal? And then the next day, something just like, kind of like, you're like,
snap.
Yeah, and you were just like, hey, it's me, it's Gomer. We were like, Gomer, what just happened? And it's been nonstop since. But like, if you understand that like, this actually has like an ending point. So give it everything that you have, and it's probably not going to end well, and that is okay because like that's like look what God did with like the life of Christ on paper not ending well. You know, but like. Like, he brought about, like the salvation of man. And, you know, like he brought, like, he, I've been
a debate a while.
Like, and, you know, and like, that's a beautiful failure. Like, that, and I think so often we forget, like, no, it's going to be, like, horrible, and you're going to bleed, and, like, everyone's going to kind of come and leave you. But, like, God's going to do, like, incredible things because of that. And when we start to understand that, I think when we look at, like, how can I be in solidarity, and we view that in the on the light of the cross, it becomes a little bit, like, easier to say, you just got to do something. And then God will, like, take it, and you'll be amazed at what happens. Like, so many of our dumbest episodes that I thought have been dumb, people have been like, that changed my life. And I've just been like, God is real, isn't he? You know, because it's like, there's no way, this is garbage. Like, you have no taste, sir.
And it's awesome how much more we could do in community, right? Like, mm-hmm. The limits of one person to make a difference. I remember moving out to Haiti thinking that, you know, I was going to save the Haitian people. Like, it's just like, and then I lived there for a year, and it's like, all right, did I even really make a drop in the ocean? Like, you really feel like, man, this problem is so much bigger, but exactly what you said about the intermediaries, like individuals coming together as communities and associations coming together, and obviously, like, even Jesus said, poverty will be with us. Like, we're not going to change the whole world. We're not going to fix the entire problem, but let's get together and fix a problem. Like, but we can only do that together. We can't do that on our own.
And, you know, the Catholic Church has a very clear teaching about the common good that I don't think Catholics understand. The common good is when a society of persons has something that is bigger than themselves that unites them. It's the principle of unity, right? So in the Catholic Church, there are thousands of ways that God has manifested his divine presence and his incarnate love to people through building these little societies, right? And, one of the problems that I think we have is we tend to be little messiahs. We really become little Napoleons. But we tend to be little messiahs, right, where we think, I'm the savior. I'm going to fix, I'm going to win. If I do the right things and say the right things and all this stuff, it'll be fixed. And that's not true. And I think one of the most humbling things is letting the false messiah within you die so that you can make room for community. Because once I realize I'm not sufficient, then I realize, well,
I need everyone else.
Yeah, I need. So that's the interdependency that we started this whole thing off with, is I cannot do this alone. I desperately need you. And wouldn't you know it, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there I am present among them. Like, that's kind of the Christian thing, is service in community. And so the Catholic Church teaching on the common good is, it's always ordered to the individual, but it's always the thing that's above any individual. Right? It's why we come together. So it's not just your vision, right? You might be the executive director, but you're not the only keeper. You're not the savior, right? So it's not just your vision. And part of the beautiful thing about having nonprofits and ministries is you let other people in, not just on the great work, but the vision itself. And the way I describe Christian ministry, especially in terms of outreach, is It is letting the things that break Christ's heart break your heart. Right? He loved us with a human heart, the Catechism says. That's the devotion of the Sacred Heart. And some of you in this room, it'll be things with the youth. Some of you in this room, it might be that, you know, you're connected with the Haiti youth thing. For some of you, it might be drug addicts or whatever it is. Prisoners for me, like, I'm a suburban kid. I don't think I've ever broken the law intentionally. I feel very repentant when I go 26 and a 25 mile an hour zone.
You were going 70 to 45.
I did. I took your picture and said
I'm going 70
and
to 45.
And I swerved when I took the picture.
It was very bad when I go 20. There are things I want to say, but they're kitchen. Find out.
Absolutely.
What I would say is patreon.com/CF. That's patreon.com/CF.
Yeah, but in this, like, the Lord called me into prison ministry. And COVID suspended that completely. Full stop. I couldn't go there. And now I've been twice. And it's amazing walking into that room and being like, okay. Like, I can't tell you how frustrating it is to do prison ministry. It's mostly just waiting in a room that smells terrible. And the guards are rolling their eyes at you. Some of the guards actively hate you because you're doing ministry to whom some of them, not all of them, view as the enemy. Right? And so I wrote a letter, I wrote an open letter that got published in their newsletter to all the corrections officers, because I don't know if you know this, but corrections officers, it's the worst job in America. Highest suicide rate, highest divorce rate, highest alcoholism rate, all this stuff. And I wrote an open letter and I said, we see you. We are not allowed to do ministry to you because it's a conflict of interest, right? If I'm working with inmates and then I go work with a guard, maybe I'm a bridge doing something shady. But I said, like, don't think that we don't love you and know you and care about you or we're lifting you up in prayer. But there is so much about prison ministry that is so mundane. Like, I show up at 4 a.m. and it takes me 2 or 3 hours of just standing around before I can get inside the building. Not because of them, but because that's our group and we're with. And I don't want to do the retreat every year. But every year when I'm in the middle of it, it all makes sense. And you have those moments where you're like, if I wasn't here, that neo-pagan priest who is here for life with multiple life sentences, who's done some horrific stuff, he would not be saved. Like, I watched a man have an instantaneous conversion right in front of my eyes, and I couldn't have done it if it wasn't 1,000 people that have come before me, the 80 men that surrounded me, you know, to do the ministry and all this stuff. And so trying to do this stuff alone is the quickest way to frustration and damnation. I said it. Damnation.
Man, we need each other.
We do.
Ought we to hope, though, that...
Dare we hope that all men be saved.
Yeah, I mean, this community of Luke and Gomer catching foxes is so like...
I was gonna hold your hand.
I know.
I went right for your fly.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. I mean, any last thoughts as we kind of wind this up?
You cannot do this alone. 6 words that I think is the heart of the gospel. Solidarity, subsidiarity, you cannot do this alone. So stop trying and start asking. St. Thomas Aquinas said, Lord, grant me the generosity to give to those who need, and grant me the humility to ask of others when I'm in need. Aristotle never would have said that. Aristotle never, he would have seen that as a thing to be despised. He actively would have. It was Alistair McIntyre talking that. And in that moment, but just think about that. To have the humility to ask, how many of us do that, right? We're ready to be generous because it magnifies us sometimes, but when we're humbled enough to say, I need this from you, like that's a very powerful thing.
Real solidarity should hurt. So if you are asking yourself, am I really in solidarity with this thing that I care about, or this thing that God has put in my heart, is it hurting me? Not in a way that's like, actually like, you know, like, I can't eat, you know, like, are you, is it a way where it's like, I am giving out this part of my life, or I am making a sacrifice to be a part of this thing, but I think it is really, really important that I do, and I think that's,
That brings it forward.
Yeah. And like that's the thing that was really evident while I was going through that. Like one thing that I had talked about earlier, that
It is when we want to be on solidarity, when we want to make actual change happen, it is all, it takes everything. And when we just do it halfway or just in this one or other thing, it doesn't really tend to work. And it takes the whole, and when I say that it takes everything, I mean your whole self. It takes the self. We need to be there. We need to serve the person as a whole, like, as a whole.
Yeah, and just imagine if people came together and felt like, yeah, like obviously not just the Mahatma Gandhi line, but actually felt like they could make a difference in the world, see the tangible results, and do it, you know, like with our Christian Catholic principles, that, you know, obviously the greatest poverty in this world is to not know the gospel. So if our solidarity ties into their human dignity, or really reaches to the depths of their soul,